Welcome to the Replay Value Podcast, where we deep dive into the movies we all love to watch over and over again. I'm Phil, joined by my brother from the same mother, our co-host on the West Coast, Warren.
What's up, bro? In this episode, we're going to talk about the psychological crime drama thriller, Martin Scorsese's masterpiece, Taxi Driver. Now, the plot of the film, a lonely Vietnam veteran works nights as a New York City taxi driver before descending into madness and insanity as he plots to assassinate a presidential candidate and kill the pimp of an underage prostitute.
This is one of those films that I'm glad I did not watch at too young of an age. I'd put it right there with a Clockwork Orange on those that group of films where our dad was like, okay, you're not watching this until you're 21, okay? You can't watch it until then. It's too mature. But boy, when I finally did watch it for the first time, it changed the way I looked at film and what a hero slash anti-hero could be. It stands up very well even to this day.
Yeah, it has aged really well. And it's a film that I can relate with to some extent, very, very limited. But
Tell me more.
The screenplay was originally based in Los Angeles, and I drove Uber at nights when I was in drama school in Los Angeles. So, you know, 7 p.m. to 4 a.m. Working nights, driving in a big city, I can relate with that aspect of it. There is a lonely element to it,
Well, when I first watched it when I was college aged, at least I would say most people, at least myself, went through bouts of insomnia where you weren't getting a lot of sleep, and there are aspects of that character you can relate to in the insomnia part of it there, but the film itself
and the loneliness, but the movie everyone can relate with that, but this movie shows what happens, what loneliness can do to an unhinged man or an unhinged person.
Right, a little bit of the PTSD, mental health issues there. But the film script, written by Paul Schrader, he himself also had some very deep personal experiences with insomnia and with loneliness, which is what inspired the writing of the script itself.
Well, at the time, he was a failed film critic, and then he turned to screenwriting. He recently divorced, didn't have a place to live. He was staying in Los Angeles, sleeping in his car and in an ex-girlfriend's house when she was out of town. So it was over, a 2 or 3 week period living in Los Angeles, isolated. He realized he hadn't spoken to anybody for several weeks. And his, neurosis and borderline psychosis led to him, cranking out 2 drafts of this script in 10 days. And he said he wrote it like an animal. I mean, it was just coming out of him.
Well, I'd seen a similar story where he had actually gone to the hospital with a stomach ulcer and was recuperating in his girlfriend's apartment or maybe an ex's apartment at the time, which is when those feelings of loneliness kicked in and that isolation and part of that is what inspired the turn to incorporate the taxi driver element into the script, being that the taxi itself, that cab, is like a steel coffin going around the city. I mean, you are very much by yourself while you're driving around.
Yeah, and through writing it, he realized that the material evolved as he was cranking out the script, that it was a self-imposed loneliness that Travis Bickle was suffering from. He made the choice to be alone.
So that was, I would say the inspiration was twofold. That was one side of it. The other side was Paul Schrader. He took those personal experiences and he also incorporated aspects of Arthur Brimmer's diaries. Arthur Brimmer being an individual who had made an assassination attempt on presidential candidate George Wallace back in the 70s. He read about that, read Brimmer's diaries, and incorporated that along with what he himself had gone through to create the character of Travis Bickle, the cabbie.
Yeah, when he finished the script, he started to gain a reputation in Hollywood as a screenwriter to be on the lookout for.
Well, up to this point, he had only had one other writing credit. He did the Yakuza, which was a film directed by Sidney Pollack. So this was his second credit Taxi Driver, and then he would end up doing three more films with Martin Scorsese, Raging Bull, Last Temptation of Christ, as well as Bringing Out the Dead. He's still doing scripts to this day, no more with Scorsese since Bringing Out the Dead, but he has, this catapulted him into that career.
Another person that's catapulted was Martin Scorsese. His fifth feature film up to this point, he'd done also four short films and three documentaries. So already a pretty busy filmmaker. Before this, Boxcar, Bertha in 72, Mean Streets in 73, and Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore in 74. So already made some good movies. In fact, Brian De Palma is the one that brought the script to Scorsese. He recommended that he direct the film.
When Taxi Driver came by, I realized I had to choose between whether I was going to make Hollywood-type pictures or more personal movies. And that's what I felt that I should do it, because I had to keep on trying to make as many personal pictures as possible within the system, within the Hollywood system. Because it doesn't matter where you live in America. If you make a film in New York or Chicago or whatever, it's still a Hollywood film. I felt that's the kind of film I should be making, because it had an honesty to it and a truthfulness about it.
I mean, I'm glad he did. I mean, with that, we got a lot of, got a great relationship with the between Scorsese and Schrader, and got some other great films out of it.
Paid only $65,000 to direct this movie.
Which at the time, I'm sure, was great for him. I mean, he's not at the point in his career where he's getting a lot of money, some big budgets to go after. So this was very much an opportunity that he capitalized on, even with the minimal salary.
Well, he wanted to do it, but the problem was he didn't have a track record. I mean, this was, when he was first approached to look at doing the movie, this was before Mean Streets had come out. And so the producers, Michael and Julia Phillips, they were interested in Scorsese, but they hadn't seen any of his work. And then the producers went and saw a screening of Mean Streets, and then midway through the movie, Michael Phillips was like, that's our guy. We want him and De Niro. So they ended up approaching with the idea of hiring Scorsese and De Niro as a team, doing it together.
Well, of course, you had De Niro coming off of his Best Supporting Actor win for Godfather 2, and he had also done Mean Streets, with Scorsese, so very much a partnership in the making in the early stages.
Yeah, so with the success of De Niro and then Scorsese's hit with Mean Streets, they were finally able to secure financing when David Begelman, who was the head of Columbia Pictures, greenlit the film.
And filming did commence in the summer of 75, which is notoriously known for having a bad heat wave in New York City, which is where they did filming, and also having a sanitation strike. So not a great time to be doing a movie. And I found it odd, well, not odd, just different that back in the 70s, they could actually film in New York City. Nowadays, they'd probably use Vancouver or Toronto to portray.
Just to get the tax breaks.
Yeah, to portray
New York
City.
Stuff up there, though.
I mean, they could do a little bit, yeah, with some of the, the scenes.
It's a lot easier just to cheat it nowadays.
Yeah. So there was not a huge budget for this, as we mentioned earlier, with Scorsese's salary. That trickled down. There wasn't a lot of money to go around, so Scorsese, the cinematographer, Michael Chapman.
I believe he was the highest paid. Most people were paid around $30,000,
$35,000. Oh, really? Wow, yeah.
Yeah.
So Scorsese, Michael Chapman, the cinematographer, and as well as the sound team, they'd really have to get creative with a lot of the ways that they were shooting. Oftentimes, they couldn't really light the taxi cab and put a rig on it. They'd have to, lay down in the trunk, pop down the seats, and sit in the back to film things.
They never towed the car.
Oh, really? Never
did. Never towed the car. De Niro was such a good driver that they just would set it up and let him drive.
That's wow.
And so just a small movie-making unit in the car. You get the director.
Yeah, so a lot of the lighting, which is very important in films, is a lot of the lighting you see is just what they're getting off the street, off of the signs, that is the natural lighting that they have that's available to them.
Yeah. And you mentioned a small budget. They got 45 days initially, but they went 5 or 6 days over. They were running into issues. Like the scenes wouldn't match because there some days it would be raining. And then, it's particularly with the first date that Betsy and Travis have in the diner. They had to change locations for that scene because they couldn't finish it. And they couldn't get it to match because it was raining one day and one day it wasn't. So a lot of, movie making issues that you don't think about when you're watching it that, as a director runs into.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a very much a learning experience, even with someone as masterful as Scorsese. I'm sure that he grew a lot, as well as his crew.
Yeah, it just makes it impossible to stay on budget, on schedule, when you're dealing with those, that kind of situation.
Especially with a slim budget, exactly.
The movie takes place between May and October 76, mostly on the west side of New York City. And they shot the final scene in an apartment, a real apartment. It wasn't a soundstage, which nowadays, of course, they would... If they had the money, they would shoot it on a soundstage. The final shootout, 3 months of planning, tracking shot. They had to cut the ceiling out. Again, if you're on a soundstage, that would be a non-issue. But to do that on location, I mean, that's that's a tall order.
Yeah, you think about that last shot where, you know, Travis is on the couch and it kind of pans over when the showing the police come in. Yeah, it's the only way. I mean, it seems that they storyboarded and Scorsese had a very specific idea of what he wanted to do. He's like, take the ceiling out. We're getting this one way or the other.
When you have a very low budget, I mean, this was a labor of love. You have to storyboard. You have to have shot lists, because the time you have on set, you got to get it in the can and keep moving. You don't have time to try stuff and do a bunch of takes. Worth pointing out, the movie wasn't originally envisioned as a New York movie. It was envisioned as an urban film. But it was, you know, with Scorsese coming on board, you know, he brought his sense of New York to it, and it shows.
Oh, yeah. I look at this as a New York film, and that's me as a non-New Yorker, but I don't really say, I mean, yes, that it's more focused in the urban areas of New York, of course. But let's be real. For the average moviegoer,
well, they're talking about the concept of the story, which is a lonely character in an urban setting. It doesn't have to be New York.
I see what you're saying.
Big,
this could be
a big city.
The principles and the themes apply to anywhere. It could take place in any city. I see what you're saying.
And Paul Schrader wrote it in Los Angeles, so right. he didn't have New York in mind when he wrote
it. Okay. Well, that being said, it takes place in New York. Some of the aspects of the film wouldn't work in many other cities other than New York, let's be real.
Yeah, I mean, it proved to be the perfect choice, perfect setting for the movie. And the Belmore Cafeteria at 28th and Park Avenue South was a real-life hangout for cab drivers, which when you see Travis hanging out with Wizard and some of the cab drivers, that's where they're at.
Oh, okay, well, that's good. I like seeing the real-life usage of set locations, kind of like our last episode, Karate Kid. All the locations there were real-life places in L.A., so that's cool. Music of Taxi Driver, there's one thing that everyone associates with this film as far as music goes, and that's that main theme that you hear that was that Bernard Herrmann did, and this was actually his final score before he passed away, and it's what a note to go out on. I mean, just a fantastic theme that captures the juxtaposition of this seedy, sleazy, horrible underbelly of New York City, and then the promise of, you know, a life or a relationship with Betsy and some more positive moments with the melodic saxophone. And then it switches right back to that percussive buildup and those haunting sounds that kind of represent what Travis is going through. So just that back and forth that you get with this theme, and just what the theme is only like a 2.5 minutes, something like that. It was just masterful work by Bernard Herrmann. So
he scored it like in what, 2 days?
Yeah, it was very quick. But now, granted, that theme, even the saxophone that you hear is used again in Betsy's theme, and it's really just that one theme used kind of stretched throughout the entire score. But it's so powerful that it works. You can take bits and pieces of it to work and plug in how it fits the particular scene.
Now, he passed away the night he finished the score, I believe is what Scorsese said.
Oh, I did not read that. I wasn't aware of that. And I think it was in 74, 75. One thing about Scorsese's films, you know, especially the later ones and like Goodfellas and whatnot, he would always like to, you know, similar to Tarantino, would use songs from pop culture. So hearing this is just a very traditional score in the sense that it had a composer. There was only one song that he used by an artist, Jackson Browne's "Late for the Sky," which was during a TV show, American Bandstand, that Travis was watching. But other than that, it was all the Bernard Herrmann score.
Well, Scorsese hired a classic film composer in Herrmann, just like a Tarantino hired Morricone in the same capacity. Bernard Herrmann scored Citizen Kane.
Yes, I was going to. You're right. He worked with Orson Welles on Citizen Kane.
I mean, that is iconic. And that's 35 years before this movie.
Well, not only that, he also worked with Alfred Hitchcock on several films, not just one. I mean, that he was like Hitchcock's go-to guy. He worked on him with The Birds, Psycho. So this is a guy that he was legendary in the industry as far
so
as...
So a film auteur like Scorsese, if he's going to get a composer, this is the guy fits the bill.
Again, that theme, though, is just so iconic to this movie and the emotion that it brings that, yeah, I'm glad he got a guy like that. It would completely change the film if he went with some pop artist or put a different song in there instead of this theme as a result.
Scorsese hired a classic composer, also references several classic films in cinema history, 1933's King Kong. Travis has the King Kong patch on his jacket, but also where King Kong wants to save Faye and she doesn't want to be saved. Travis wants to save Iris and she doesn't want to be saved. So
okay, yeah.
There are some parallels there. Streetcar Named Desire, the train station scene. 62's Lolita, Iris, a young underage woman being objectified and sexualized. Iris in the same way as Lolita was. And most prominently, The Searchers from 1956, another story where a girl doesn't want saving. And then you have the Travis motivation based on Ethan Edwards in the film.
Yeah, this is looked at pretty commonly looked at as the spiritual successor to that film and some of the aspects that it takes on.
We even have Black Legion from 1937, The Front of a Mirror with a Gun. That a similar scene there. And then 1947, Odd Man Out, where he stares at the bubbles in his drink, which is a really cool shot Scorsese has in this movie.
Yeah, oh, with the seltzer when he puts it in, yeah.
Yeah.
A cinephile like Scorsese, you're going to see deep cuts and references, just like you will with something like a Tarantino film, yeah.
And we'll move on to the stars of the picture.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
A decorated ensemble, 3 Oscar winners, 2 nominees, and 1 Emmy winner, 1 Emmy nominee. Starting at the top of the call sheet with 2-time Oscar winner Robert De Niro. He was Oscar nominated for this role, his 2nd movie with Scorsese, and his 12th film credit.
Yeah, the first being Mean Streets, which we mentioned earlier, yeah.
And then he was coming off, as we mentioned, also the Oscar win from Godfather Part 2. This would end up being his 2nd Oscar nomination in this movie, and he was only paid $35,000. He turned down several $500,000 offers to take this movie instead.
You recognize what you've got with Scorsese. That's really the only explanation there is. It's as he saw the genius that was there and wanting to work with him.
Ended up being a wise choice. Only had 2 weeks to prepare. He went to an army base in northern Italy, and he tape-recorded some of the soldiers there that had a Midwestern accent that he thought Travis Bickle would have. He lost 35 pounds, and you see some of those scenes, particularly when the character's transitioning, and that's on display. He was shooting 1900 in Italy with Bertolucci at the time, and what he would do is would wrap filming on Friday and while Taxi Driver was in pre-production, would fly back to New York, get his taxi driver permit, and would drive cabs 12 hours a day around New York City to prepare for the role.
It's just an insane level to go to for preparation. I mean, it couldn't have been safe, really, to do that. I mean, especially for if you get recognized. I mean, who knows what's going to happen.
Even though he just won the Oscar for Godfather, he had said he wasn't a famous face yet. He only got recognized 1 time.
Another thing that he would do is he actually listened to taped readings of Arthur Brimmer's diaries to kind of get in the mindset of the inspiration for the Travis Bickle character. So, I mean, you have all these links that he's going through to get inside the role of Travis Bickle.
Yeah, De Niro got deep into this character. He stayed in character, method actor, through the entire production of the film. That's how committed he was to the character. He started on the outside in. He started with the jacket and dungarees. They call that as an actor, you have the approach inside out or outside in. So he used the outside in approach with Travis Bickle. And his work, it's one of the great performances given by an actor in cinema history. And that is why I have to go ahead and give the MVP to Robert De Niro. He gives the most valuable performance in the movie. It's not even close. And it's realistic performance that just makes it so unsettling. There's nothing theatrical about what he does. You never once occurs to you, you never see Robert De Niro acting. He just is Travis Bickle. And the talent is showcased. Coming off Godfather Part 2, you see how charismatic and charming he is playing a young Vito Don Corleone, and then you see him unhinged as Travis Bickle. And the difference of behaviors, and you can see him embodying two different characters, proves just how talented of an actor that he is. And that's why he's the MVP. He's in every scene of the movie except one, which was wasn't even in the script. It was added in to give Harvey Keitel more screen time.
when he's talking to Iris about, you know, yeah, he being number one girl. Yeah. That scene actually kind of sticks out. It feels weird because you're like, you don't. I guess the first time I watched it, I didn't realize something was wrong. I was like, oh, Travis Bickle's not in the scene. You see him in the rest of the film. And there might be a moment or two with Betsy and Tom that he's not involved in, but he's always like watching, you know, from the outside or whatnot. But
well, they added that in later because Scorsese didn't want to feel like he was violating the point of view of Travis Bickle. That's why if you watch, they cut to Travis parked outside, even though he couldn't actually see Sport and Iris. Scorsese did that as kind of a cheat to make sure that he wasn't trying to break the point of view.
Yeah, there's no other choice for MVP here. Again, in every scene, you know, what are you going to do? He is Oscar nominated for the performance. So if you went in with anyone else, it would have been a sacrilege.
Yeah, it's one of the most memorable, iconic acting performances in cinema history by one of its greatest actors. And moving on to another two-time Oscar winner, Jodie Foster as Iris. She was also Oscar nominated for this role, and this was also her second movie with Martin Scorsese.
12 years old, it was somewhat of a controversial casting at the time. She did have to undergo California state mandated psychological testing just at UCLA to make sure that, you know, she would be okay. And so that was standard procedure for child actors, especially, you know, in this type of material. But during this time shooting the film, she did form a relationship with Robert De Niro, a kind of a mentee relationship, and ended up looking up to him through a lot of the filming.
Yeah, they rehearsed together over and over and over again because she was a young actress. She knew her lines cold and would get bored, and De Niro would try different things to throw her off, and she started to really appreciate all the hard work that De Niro did with her, because De Niro would just want to rehearse it over and over and over and over again.
Well, she has gone on record saying, even, you know, now as an adult, that the path that her acting career took was very much influenced by observing how De Niro worked. What a treat to get that at 12 years old to you know, further your career by watching one of, and observing one of the greatest of all time.
Yeah, it elevated her. But given her age, she already had a lot of experience, 29 TV credits and 6 film credits. So, I mean, that's for a 13-year-old girl, that's a lot of work at that age to have already gotten in the books.
Yeah, at that point, when I was 12 or 13, I would only really care where food services was. I mean, just show me, point me in the
Crafty
direction. Exactly. That's all I would care about.
Craft services.
Yeah. Craft services. There you go. Yeah.
Moving on to 4-time Emmy nominee Cybill Shepherd as Betsy. This was her 5th movie. And initially, when she took a look at the material, was offended. She was pissed off. She thought it was a small part, was insulted, and quote, threw the script across the floor.
Wow. Didn't read that. To be fair, that's probably a pretty good way to react for the Betsy character, considering how she acts in some of the scenes in the film itself.
Well, the Columbia felt the film needed more star power. Mm. And so enter Cybill Shepherd, which at the time she was an up and comer. She'd been in a handful of films already, but was destined for great things at that point.
I guess, you know, being that Scorsese wasn't a huge well-known name, a huge commodity in the industry, I can see maybe just like, well, this isn't enough for me to do. Because, I mean, for after the first act, after that failed second date between her and Travis, that she really doesn't have a whole lot in the film.
Yeah, she doesn't. But it was after she went to rehearsals and started working with the other actors and Scorsese that she had a change of heart. And what happened is her dialogue was discovered through rehearsal. They came up with the improv through rehearsal because, again, small budget, you don't have the time to improv on set. You do rehearsals to figure out the improv, so the improv is scripted on the day.
Yeah, I did read that a lot of the scenes were that way, was improv through rehearsals, especially the scene with her and Travis at the diner when they have coffee. So, yeah, I mean, that's just, again, one of them, but much of the dialogue was done that way.
It was done to add realism. It never hurt the story.
It really came across, especially with Travis's character and some of the way he kind of fumbles and stutters through his lines. It makes a lot of sense, and it benefited the character to have that authenticity.
Well, I'd say the actor that improv the most in terms of like when he's on screen is Albert Brooks as Tom. this was his feature film debut. He had 5 TV credits up to this point. He'd been doing a lot of stand-up comedy on TV at the time. And they hired a comic for a nothing character because on the page he was a nothing character. So they brought in Albert Brooks. Scorsese was a fan and cast him to bring some levity to the material because, you know, outside of his scenes, it's pretty dark.
Well, yeah. Plus, I mean, Betsy would seem very much alone. Not that she's with Tom, Albert Brooks's character, but he helps to bring life to that office, the political office of Palantine, you know, that where she's like, it very much feels like a workplace because he's there because she communicates with someone else that you wouldn't get if his character didn't have any dialogue.
Another actor in this movie that does a lot with a little is Harvey Keitel.
Oh, yeah.
As Sport, his 4th Scorsese movie. So they made their feature film debuts together.
Wow.
And only his 5th film overall. So outside of Scorsese, he'd only made one other movie. And he was originally approached to play the campaign worker, Tom, Albert Brooks' character. But once Harvey read the script, Harvey wanted to play the pimp role. He thought that was more interesting.
Well, Harvey Keitel doesn't get friend-zoned, I'll tell you that. So he's like, I'm not going to be friend-zoned to this little Tom-ass character. I'm going to be a pimp. Now, that's funny.
I think it had more to do with where he lived at the time.
I'm just messing around.
Oh, I know. But he was living in Hell's Kitchen. He based it on a pimp that he used to see all the time in the neighborhood. He wore a wig, similar to, most notably, Travis Bickle, the Mohawk, which, spoilers, is not a real Mohawk, despite him being method and completely dedicated to the character. That was a wig piece and very sophisticated bald caps with the hair follicles coming out that where it's buzzed.
Yeah, I was very surprised to learn that, because I would have bet that was actually him shaving down to a Mohawk. So I was surprised to see that.
Well, with the wig at first, production wouldn't approve it. They told him they didn't have any money for it. Harvey Keitel went and got Marty Scorsese, told him he needed the wig, and then Marty called him and was like, give him whatever he needs.
Well, of course, yeah.
Was very dedicated to the character. He also rehearsed with the pimp, and they would swap roles to help really get into the skin of Sport, which probably isn't the easiest thing to do.
No, I imagine not. I mean, it's almost a little off-putting when you first watch the movie, if you've seen Keitel in anything else, seeing him as a pimp, but you are quickly put at ease and you quickly see him in the role because he's so good at it.
Co-stars in the movie, Emmy winner Peter Boyle as Wizard.
Yeah.
A couple memorable moments and more or less a cameo, Victor Argo as Emilio. His 3rd Scorsese movie, he plays the convenience store owner. You got the vigilante scene there. He was also in King of New York. Love that. And True Romance. So he's been and worked with a lot of great directors. Stephen Prince as Andy, the gun salesman, who was a friend of Martin Scorsese. He was not an actor, but he came in on the day and crushed.
Very memorable scene. Yeah, he's great in it.
Scorsese also made a documentary with him as well. So he had a close relationship with him.
Scorsese himself as the passenger that was looking in on his wife. I mean, probably the lengthiest cameo that Scorsese has had in one of his films.
His most memorable, for sure.
He was very good. I was, you know, surprised at how good he did in that role.
Yeah, he was great. And Diane Abbott as the concession girl at the porno theater. That was De Niro's girlfriend at the time. She's also the cousin of Gregory Abbott, the singer-songwriter.
All right, we'll move on to the stats and accolades of Taxi Driver. Release date, February 7th, 1976, on a meager budget of $1.9 million. You knew it'd be small based on our salary talk from earlier. Opening weekend, it was a little bit different back then. The stats are a little harder to track from that era than they are now. The only thing I could find that it opened to 68,000 at the Coronet Theater in New York City, which was a record for that theater at the time. It eventually would go on to, I think, be released in close to 1,000 screens. Domestically, pulled in $28.2 million. $27.3 million of that was from the original release in 1976. And then another $960,000 was from its 1996 20th anniversary re-release. So it did, and it sprinkled around through worldwide markets here and there over the past 20 years or so, but very, very limited, all things considered.
And despite the limited release, still finished in the top 20 of 1976 at number 17.
Which, you know, that's a lot of that's most likely word of mouth.
The film was a hit, yeah.
Yeah. Availability to see it, too. I mean, this is not something that you could see in your hometown. Most people would have had to have traveled to see it. So it says a lot for the movie.
Yeah, it didn't come out on DVD till 1999 in a collector's edition.
Wow.
A 30th anniversary two-disc collector's edition in 2006 and a 35th anniversary Blu-ray in 2011.
We just take it for granted so much at how easy it is to access films, especially from that era. Now, like, you would have to wait so long for a VHS or a DVD. Now we're
I think it's on Netflix right now. You just pull it up and watch it.
It's so accessible to you now. Yeah, we definitely take it for granted.
And it's a quick watch, less than 2 hours, 114 minutes.
Yeah, it's crazy because, I mean, isn't Karate Kid, the previous film we did, isn't it a slightly longer?
Yeah. And with an R rating, almost didn't get that, almost was given an X rating. There's quite a legendary story with the MPAA with the violence, particularly in the final shootout.
Nobody talks about X ratings anymore, but I feel like I remember, like, growing up, you'd kind of hear about, ooh, an X rated movie, and you would just automatically want to see it just because it was that that cut off from being from the public. There was some allure to the movie. You didn't even really know what it was about or what the X rating was for. You just wanted to watch it, you know, because you weren't supposed to see it. So you don't even hear about that anymore. It's not even a thing.
Yeah, it was a much bigger deal back then. But there's a great legendary story in Hollywood lore about how Scorsese was going to deal with the MPAA because he had made this masterpiece and they weren't going to give him the R rating that he needed to release it. So I thought it was, got to hear Tarantino tell this story, Hollywood legend of the Scorsese MPAA taxi driver.
And just a quick PSA, about midway through the interview, you will hear what sounds like a scene from the film playing under Quentin Tarantino while he's talking. That is part of the interview. It is not an audio glitch, but regardless, it is a legendary Hollywood story.
The people or person at Columbia, who I don't have a clue who it is or if this even happened at all, was unsympathetic. They didn't care. They were just get an R. Just get an R. We don't care how you do it, just do it. And the legend goes that Scorsese stayed up all night drinking, getting drunk with a loaded gun. And his purpose was, in the morning, he was going to shoot the executive at Columbia for making him cut his masterpiece. And it turned out to be a vigil all night as Scorsese sat there with a loaded gun in his lap, and some of his fellow filmmakers and friends came and talked to him and commiserated with him and tried to talk him out of it. And apparently this lasted all night long. I've heard stories that literally all of them grew up that night because they realized how serious Scorsese was at the prospect of what he was going to do. Well, apparently what ended up happening is by the end of the night, by truly, truly contemplating shooting the man and knowing he was going to do that, when that became such a reality, he did reach inside of himself to try to find one other thing he could do other than commit murder. And the idea that came to him was just to desaturate the color in the final shootout by 2 degrees, turning what was candy apple blood red into a more burgundy blood. He did that in lieu of killing a man, and the film got its R.
Which just goes to show, I guess you can use as much blood as you want as long as it's just a slightly different color than what it should be, which is kind of crazy that the MPAA was hung up on that, because watching it, it's still incredibly graphic. I do not think that the color red would make that much of an impact to your audience.
It makes more of it than you would think. It doesn't make it so jarring or so shocking. It softens the blow visually a little bit. But there's only a body count of 4. So we talk about how graphic it is, but there's only 4 people at the end of the day that are killed in the movie. You know, compared to like Rambo or something where, you know, the body count's in the hundreds.
That's true.
And 33 F-bombs in the movie.
Fuck you!
I was going to do scores of the film, but in preparing for this episode, I came across the Scorsese Blast Film Scores. It says it devalues cinema, so fuck them for this episode. We're not going to do any scores for Taxi Driver.
They're pretty good, though. So anyway.
Yeah, the scores are great, but I'm saying fuck the scores. We're not going to do them.
Yeah, it's what the audience thinks. I've always said that. It's what the fans matter. That's why you see critics say one thing when the film releases, and then come back and, you know, revisit the film and change their review. Because what matters is how it ages and how it's perceived in pop culture and in the zeitgeist.
Oh, man. Critics, universal acclaim right out of the chute. Roger Ebert, 4 out of 4 stars, said, quote, one of the greatest movies I've ever seen, unquote. Pauline Kael said, quote, the fact that we experience Travis's need for explosion viscerally and that the explosion itself has the quality of consumption makes Taxi Driver one of the few truly modern horror films, unquote. Awards of the film, 4 Oscar nominations, Best Picture, Best Music, Best Actor, and Best Supporting Actress. 1 Grammy nomination, 2 Golden Globe nominations, 3 BAFTA wins, and 4 nominations, and it also won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, with another 17 wins and 9 nominations.
Which to some, that I would say is more prestigious than Best Picture win, or right up there with it.
That's the world stage.
Exactly, yes. Grammy Record of the Year for 1976. The award went to This Masquerade by George Benson. Not one that I'm very familiar with. The Billboard Hot 100 top single for year ending 1976. However, I do know it's Silly Love Songs by Wings, the Paul McCartney group. So I'm a fan of that. Wings, very, very good band. So some good music then, and some not so memorable music from that time as well.
Yeah, well, pretty memorable movies for 1976. Number 1 at the box office, Rocky.
Yes.
Also the double crown holder, Best Picture winner for the year. The rare distinction of just a handful of episodes we've done thus far.
Yeah, so this is the first film from 1976 that we've done. But as you've just heard, based on Rocky being also released that year, will not be the last.
Number 2, To Fly. Number 3, A Star is Born. Number 4, King Kong. Both of those 3 and 4 being remakes. And then number 5, Silver Streak. Grandma's, that was her favorite movie.
Really? Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's a great film. I would put Rocky as a deserving number 1, though.
Oh, for sure. Other movies of the year, All the President's Men at number 6, The Omen at number 7, and Bad News Bears at number 10.
Oh, wow, yeah. Classic horror and classic family film, yeah.
Classic sports movie, man. TV of the year, top 5 Nielsen scripted shows. Number 1, Happy Days. Number 2, Laverne and Shirley. Number 3 was the ABC Monday Night Movie. Number 4 was MASH. And number 5, Charlie's Angels.
Good TV. MASH, man, what a great show.
Speaking of great shows, Emmy Best Comedy Series winner, The Mary Tyler Moore Show. It was
a three-peat.
It was a three-peat in its final season.
Okay, final year. I was wondering. Yeah, it seemed late for Mary Tyler. Yeah.
Going out like MJ there, three-peat before retirement. And then the Emmy Best Drama Series winner, Upstairs, Downstairs, which was its third win in four seasons, and it was also its final season. Prices in 1976, gas was 59 cents a gallon. A new car was $4,100. A movie ticket was $2.13. Rent cost you $220. A new house was $48,000, all on an average income of $12,686. Events of 1976, the Apple computer was formed by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. NASA unveils its first space shuttle, the Enterprise, kind of a based on a little Star Trek there. Yeah. The Winter Olympics is held in Austria. The $2 bill is issued. The United States celebrates its bicentennial celebration. And Jimmy Carter was elected president.
Wow. Wow. It's so... I mean, we we do so many 80s, 90s, and you know later movies that when you kind of hear one back further, it just really puts things into perspective.
Oh, this will really put it in perspective. Guess who was born in 1976? And there's a shitload, but I'm just going to go over a couple. Reese Witherspoon.
Oh, okay.
Colin Farrell. Okay. Benedict Cumberbatch. Ryan Reynolds. Diane Kruger. Alicia Silverstone. Anna Faris. And a whole lot more.
I cannot believe all those people are the same age. What? All right, let's talk about our best scenes and lines from Taxi Driver. A lot of memorable moments in this film. I'm sure we're going to match up on at least one of them, I would say. But let's start with your runner-up, Warren.
My runner-up best scene, I had to go with the assassination attempt. The reason being is this is like the turning point in the movie. Where the cheese has officially slid off the cracker. He is batshit nuts, and we're hanging on the edge of our seat to see what's going to happen. And it's, you know, it's displayed even with how he dresses and, of course, the mohawk at that point. But the film is so exhilarating at that point. That's really when the tension of the film really takes it to another gear.
That reveal of the mohawk, I had that as an honorable mention in the ensuing assassination attempt. But a little backstory on that, the idea for the mohawk came from Victor Magnotta, who was a friend of Scorsese's and a Vietnam veteran himself. He ended up having a cameo in the film as the Secret Service photographer, the one that tries to get a picture of Bickle as he moves away. But that was based on his real life experience where he would see guys in the war that would get that mohawk haircut. And that meant that they were ready to kill and that pretty much you just need to steer clear of them. You don't want to mess with them. So that symbolism of Bickle with the mohawk was that was like you so eloquently put the cheese has slid off the cracker. So great choice for runner up.
What was your runner up?
I had to pick the job interview.
Oh, I had that as an honorable mention. It almost was my runner-up. Almost.
Well, you know the old expression.
Did we just become best friends?
Nope.
So what do you do now?
You know, ride around nights, mostly. Subways, buses. Figure, you know, I'm gonna do that. I might as well get paid for it.
Want to work uptown nights, South Bronx, Harlem?
I'll work anytime, anywhere.
Will you work Jewish holidays?
Anytime, anywhere.
All right, let me see your chauffeur's license. How's your driving record?
It's clean. It's real clean, like my conscience.
Are you going to break my chops? You don't trouble with guys like you coming in and break my chops all the time. If you're going to break my chops, you can take it on the arches right now. You understand?
Sorry, sir. I didn't mean that.
It's just so brilliantly done, and it's just great screenwriting, and you take it for granted out of how good it is, how much you learn about the character of Bickle without...
No exposition.
No exposition. Yes, exactly. How much you pick up on the character through that job interview, how great it's acted.
How great it's written. I mean, it's a combination of great writing and execution in the performance.
It's so underrated. I don't feel like a lot of people give it the justice that it's due of how good it is. And there's
it's not even what he says. It's how he says it.
Yes, yes. It's just like anytime, anywhere, anytime. Just like the
he's so disconnected. Like the moonlighting comment just goes right over his head. He does it. What's moonlighting? He has no idea.
And that's kind of a, it's plants the seed when he's like, I don't really know a whole lot about films later in the movie, or I don't know a lot about books or records or music or anything. He doesn't know a lot about nothing, you know, to kind of put to put it in a crude terms. But yeah, that was my runner up. Just a fantastic scene. All right, what was your winner?
My winner best scene is, I mean, you got to pick. It's the final shootout. It's the climax of everything that's been built to. I just appreciate the filmmaking. It's just, we talk about the execution of De Niro's performance, but this scene is the execution of Scorsese's directing at a very high level. We talked about how much time they spent preparing, storyboarding, shot listing, cutting out the ceiling to the set, or not even the set, a real apartment in New York City. So they went all out for this scene, and it shows, and it has this great combination of it's choreographed, but it's choreographed chaos. When you're watching the scene, nothing feels like it's planned. It has this spontaneous nature to it, and that adds to the realistic element to the shootout. It isn't pretty.
Yeah, it's not your typical Hollywood shootout. As we talked about earlier, it's very bloody with the whole MPAA controversy. It's scattered, so I can see why you picked that. And a lot of work went into it, so from a preparation standpoint, it's a worthy winner. I did have as an honorable mention, though. I hate to say it.
I mean, Scorsese should have been nominated for Best Director. Ugh.
Yeah. My winner, and it's a little bit of a cheat. I'm going to go ahead and kind of reveal both of them here. It was my winner for Best Scene and Best Line, because it's within that scene. It's when De Niro is acting out, of course, the scene with you talking to me.
I'm standing here. You make the move. Your move. I'm trying, you fuck. You talking to me? You talking to me? You talking to me? Then who the hell else are you talking? You talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here. Who the fuck do you think you're talking to? Oh, yeah? Huh? Okay.
Huh? How can you not pick that as your winner? Come on, man.
That's my winner best line.
Right. But, it's my
most iconic line in cinema. One of the most iconic lines in cinema history. How are you going to shoehorn it into scenes? It should be lines.
It's both. It is simultaneously my best line. So we matched up there.
What? Did we just become best friends?
Yep.
But the scene itself is my best scene from the film. I love that. I mean, it's so well acted. It's like iconic acting scene by De Niro. Come on. I thought we were going to have a double matchup because they're contained in the same one. But before we talk about our other lines, what were your honorable mentions for best scene? Some other ones.
Well, I have two shots that are honorable mentions. The opening shot, Travis's taxi emerges from the cloud of steam or the smoke there. It just sets the tone of the movie right away. You talk about the first scene, the job interview, which is the first scene with dialogue. It sets such a great impression. That opening shot sets a powerful impression as well.
I did also have that as an honorable mention, but it was also for another reason. The film title designer, Dan Perry, he did the whole title sequence for the film. He wanted to work with Scorsese before, or I should say Scorsese wanted to work with him, but he didn't have enough clout, so Warner Brothers wouldn't allow it. However, prior to Taxi Driver, he worked on The Exorcist, which gave him the clout for Scorsese to sign him on. He would then go on to do the title sequences for Star Wars, one of those famous of all time, and then Raging Bull. So connection there. So yeah, I had to have that as an honorable mention with the Star Wars alum.
Well, I did not know that. And the second shot is where Travis is on the phone with Betsy, and it was a unique and innovative shot where the camera is sitting on Travis, and then it just pans over to the empty hallway, and it represents a moment of emptiness for Travis. And Scorsese said at the time it was the most important shot in the movie.
Didn't pick up on the symbolism there, but I like that. That makes sense. Yeah, great shot. Great conversation too with the two of them. Just
it's so sad. It's so sad, man.
I feel like I've been there. I've been in an awkward situation with a friend or a girl you're trying to something where it's just like you feel like you're trying to push the conversation forward and just trying to just get
it. It's just not happening.
It's not happening. You're trying to, can I call you again? You want to meet up, do something? You're just so that desperation, you know. But
that sucks.
I did have two honorable mentions, and they're similar in some ways. They're rare, bright moments of the film. The one is the coffee that he has with Betsy.
When I walked in and I saw you two sitting there, I could just tell by the way you were both relating that there was no connection whatsoever. And I felt when I walked in that there was something between us. There was an impulse that we were both following. So that gave me the right to come in and talk to you. Otherwise, I never would have felt that I had the right to talk to you or say anything to you. I never would have had the courage to talk to you. And with him, I felt there was nothing, and I could sense it. And when I walked in, I knew I was right. Did you feel that way?
I wouldn't be here if I didn't.
Well, you had this sense of hope. For Travis, and you know, his unusual nature comes across a little bit, but you know, she's very much smitten by him, and you have hope for it.
Yeah, you
for
see
him,
it. Man, it's so short lived, though. It ends so much sooner than you think it's going to. At least the first time when you watch it.
Yeah, I mean, just it was just a matter of time. Yeah, the date. I mean, just the life he leads. But and then the second one was with his. My other honorable mention was his breakfast with Iris.
Why do you want me to go back to my parents? I mean, they hate me. Why do you think I split in the first place? There ain't nothing there.
Yeah, but you can't live like this. It's a hell. A girl should live at home.
Didn't you ever hear of women's lib?
What do you mean, women's lib? You're a young girl. You should be at home now. You should be dressed up. You should be going out with boys. You should be going to school. You know, that kind of stuff.
Which is another similar, just kind of good moment of hope. He, you know, comes across in a very good way, very warm, and has this bond with this person that he's trying to rescue in a sense.
So. Yeah. Despite how warped and you know, crazy is when he comes off having at least good intentions at heart.
Right. So in a very dark movie, those two moments stuck out to me as something. It's like, hey, you know what? There, this is.
Yeah,
I can. It's good to see that human side of Travis.
Well, that adds that classic anti-hero element. Scenes right. Like that. Yeah, I only have a couple more honorable mentions. When Easy Andy sells Travis the guns,
$350 for the Magnum, $250 for the .38, $125 for the .25, $150 for the .380. You take this. Oh, wait here. I'll walk down with you. How about dope? Grass, ash, coke, mescaline, downers. Nebutol, Toinol, chloral hydrates. How about uppers, amphetamines?
No, I'm not interested in that stuff.
Crystal meth, I can get you crystal meth. Nitrous oxide. How about that? How about a Cadillac? I get you a brand new Cadillac with the pink slip for $2,000.
This scene set the bar for all movies where a character buys an illegal gun. I mean, it really did. It was the first of its kind, and it made such an impression. And you almost see it in every scene since then. It's just a very larger than life sales character.
I feel like I saw it like in Breaking Bad. Whenever Walter White goes to buy it, kind of reminded me of that in a way.
Oh, I'm sure they pulled from it. He ends up buying four guns in the scene. Travis spares no expense.
Yeah, so much so that Easy Andy is just like, hey, I got a Cadillac. I can do this. I can get you that. He's like, I'm going to upsell the hell out of this guy.
Yeah.
Some uppers, downers, and Escalade. I mean, okay.
And then my last honorable mention is actually the first time he puts those guns into use is at the convenience store. It's Vigilante Justice. Travis's first taste of action.
Give me the rest of the goddamn
That's
cash.
That's all I got. What
you got more. Give me more.
Reach Tell in your me I got sock. No money.
Reach in your sock. You got more bread.
That's it, man.
Give me the rest of the fucking bread.
Hey.
Get him?
Yeah, I got him.
Yeah, I mean, you went the violence vigilante route for your scenes. I was trying to do the more hopeful side of Travis.
that's the currents of the film. That's when the film pivots. That's its breaks or beats in the movie. That's when the characters starts to change, and it shows how great De Niro is in the movie. Because even like when he starts to rid himself of weakness, you start to see De Niro's performance, his posture changes. He has more of a direct focus in his eyes. So there's such a nuance to his character arc and how he changes with the character. Those moments just showcase it for me.
All right, let's talk about our best lines. You already know my winner was you talking to me, and we actually already, it's our, both of our winners. We matched up on that one. So let's do your runner-up, Warren.
Runner-up, it's the monologue near the beginning of the movie.
May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and the trash off the sidewalks. I'm working long hours now. 6 in the afternoon to 6 in the morning, sometimes even 8 in the morning. 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. It's a long hustle, but it keeps me real busy. I can take in 350 a week, sometimes even more when I do it off the meter.
I really love this monologue because it takes us into the bowels of Travis's world and in the city and his job and his day-to-day life.
All the animals come out at night. Whores, skunk pussies, buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies. Sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets.
You know, it made me think of that the pilot of Dexter, when Dexter has a similar monologue when he's driving around in the night of Miami. You almost think that they had to pull from this for that, because it very much has a similar tone. But it just takes you into the ride you're about to go on.
I can see that, yeah. I mean, even if they didn't draw from it directly, I mean, it had to have influenced it in some way. Just have that association with, you know, the lonely person driving in a car, and it's very much had to have been pulled from that for Dexter. So,
and what was your runner up?
My runner up is the monologue where he starts talking about the training and the planning that he has to do.
June 29th. I gotta get in shape now. Too much sitting has ruined my body. Too much abuse has gone on for too long. From now on, it'll be 50 push-ups each morning, 50 pull-ups. There'll be no more pills. There'll be no more bad food. No more destroyers of my body. From now on, it'll be total organization. Every muscle must be tight.
It's kind of scary. It'd be inspiring if he was doing it for any other reason than what he is, but I mean, you have to admire him, and just seeing the transformation that Bickle goes through is it's crazy to watch. But it was a very great delivery by De Niro as the character. What honorable mentions did you have?
I only had a few.
Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore, who would not let... Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is someone who stood up.
And then you mentioned it in your runner-up best scene is the anytime, anywhere.
Anytime, anywhere.
Anytime, anywhere. Anytime, I love that. I love the way he says that. I'm glad you mentioned that one. Yeah, that's very good.
Such a unique delivery. Like, you could audition 1,000 actors, no actor would say it like that. And my last honorable mention is De Niro when he shoots sport and he says,
"Suck on this."
It's such a wacky, I mean,
it's such a, but it's probably the only like cheesy line in the movie, or hard to say, one of the hard to say lines. And it, I always love it when a great actor just finds a way to finds the right line reading for it.
Hey, you know, it's cheesy, but yeah, you don't care. Yeah. Moving on to Judge Bob's recasting court, where Warren and I recast the film with today's stars. All rise for the Honorable Judge Bob presiding.
Gentlemen, you may be seated. Recasting court is now in session. Counselors, looking forward to hearing your arguments tonight. Let's get right into it. We're going to hear a recasting for sport. Tom, Betsy, Iris, and Travis Bickle. I believe Make It Take It rules give the floor to Warren. And we're going to start out with sport.
Hello. Sport. There was a few candidates that came to mind. Casey Affleck, Sam Rockwell, Michael Shannon. But I ended up settling on Jeremy Renner. This character's from the wrong side of the tracks, and the closest character that Jeremy Renner's played like this before would have to be his character in The Town. And I would love to see him portray more characters like that. It arguably is his best work in that movie, and I would love to see what he would do with the role of Sport.
Phil, who do you have cast for Sport here?
Well, you're right in that ballpark with Casey Affleck and Sam Rockwell as well. Both great character actors, Oscar nominated.
Oscar winners. Oscars, actually. Yeah.
Oscar winners, yeah. I went with, very much the same vein, kind of a devil may care, good-natured, laughing, but also threatening in that same type of way. Went with the Punisher, John Bernthal. He's got experience with in previous Scorsese films. He fits the archetype of the sport character and the kind of, the dangerously playful side. So I see him as a great candidate for both aspects of that character. Perfect fit.
Yeah, Berthold, that's right on the money. We're both picking from the right tree. But I believe Jeremy Renner, again, given what he did in The Town, I love that performance so much. And he hasn't played a lot of characters like that. I think I'm not really a fan of him in the Marvel films as Hawkeye, just probably because he isn't given a lot to do. I think maybe he's miscast a little bit. I just see him. His strength is playing different types of characters like sport.
Yeah, it's a weird casting of him as Hawkeye. He's a great actor. I think Hawkeye's just the last Avenger everyone wants to be. You know, if you're playing a video game with all the Avengers, nobody wants to be Hawkeye.
Yeah, I think he signed on for that role before he had really blown up, before he even got like the Jason or the Bourne Legacy role. Yeah. Before he really became a star and was, leading franchises, he maybe... A few years later, he maybe doesn't take that the Hawkeye role.
Yeah, I just can't see him as a pimp is my only thing. Or I can't see him over John Bernthal. I feel like Bernthal is a better fit. Love Renner. I feel like he'd be better in this than, say, the Avengers. It'd be cool to see him in that role, but I think Bernthal's the better fit.
I think if we had a time machine, we go back in time and all we know about Renner is The Town, some of the early work in his career. It's a slam dunk. I mean, it's a great casting, and I can see that. I really can. I think that the way that the careers have gone and the fact that Renner played Hawkeye, it does skew my opinion a little bit, seeing some of his other work and the different angles he's gone. For those matters, I'm going to go with John Bernthal. I think that was a great casting, Phil.
Yeah, I'm not going to be too upset about that. Bernthal's
great. Plus, the Scorsese.
Yeah. Kind of wish I would have thought of him. Yeah, he's really – he should have made my short list.
All right, moving on to Tom. Phil, who do you got?
Well, this was a tough recasting. Albert Brooks is phenomenal, bringing that character to life. The guy who is friend zoned, you can laugh at him. I mean, but at the same time, you don't really want to be his friend. You don't want to be him. He's just that type of character. So a little Weasley in some ways, and you don't exactly trust his motives with Betsy. End of the day, he's just an office friend. I felt Jesse Eisenberg has the look, which is primarily where I was going with this, is just the kind of the profile of Tom and Albert Brooks in the film. So to me, though, Eisenberg can fit that category very well.
Okay. If the role of Tom was an extra and he didn't have speaking parts, you would cast off of his picture like you did. Okay. But because Tom is a principal actor, you need to cast off their performance, their behaviors. And that is why... Just like Scorsese went with a comedian to fill the role of Tom because there wasn't it was an empty, nothing character on the page. All of his dialogue was figured out through rehearsal and ultimately being improv. So you got to go with someone who's going to bring some levity to the film. I went with Bill Burr. He's, in terms of comedian actors, he's near the top of the list, and he's been in some prestigious projects, Breaking Bad, The Mandalorian. So he's been a part of films that have really worked. And if I have to bring a comedian on board, I trust Bill Burr the most.
He was actually in a movie with Hugh Jackman, like The Politician or something like that, where it was kind of a political type of movie as well. So I didn't even think about the comedy angle. You did your research. So I'll have to commend you with that. I guilty as charged. I went with the central casting or whatever the method. I'm looking at headshots, baby.
Casting extras, man. What are you doing?
I'm looking at headshots. Come on.
Yeah, that's what they do when they cast extras. The headshot gets the actor the audition. He's got, at the end of the day, he's got to bring the goods, or he's not getting the job.
Yeah, fair enough.
This character has there's a lot to it. The main thing here is that I do see him as kind of helpless, in love. These are like interns on a campaign trail. I see some youthfulness and some of that. He's just in love with this girl, man. He really is. Kind of in a pathetic way, in a sense. And I just thought Jesse portrayed it better. And it may be the picture like casting like Phil had there, but I can see it more where Bill Burr.
Well, I see where you're coming from is that the friend zone aspect. It's hard for me to see Bill Burr getting friend zone. Like, I love the comedian.
It's like a college intern.
It's not. It's absolutely. He's not, doesn't play the leading man in pride. He plays typically plays supporting.
No, I'm not saying he's a different type of supporting. I mean, he would.
But you could totally see him getting friend zone and being frustrated about it, even playing into the anger element where his bark's louder than his bite. He
would
upset
go out there and pick a fight with
anything.
Travis Bickle.
But then he'd get his ass kicked or he'd back down, and that would be fun. But very few people are beating Bickle because it's the dog that's willing to die that's going to win that fight, and that dog is Travis Bickle. Watch out.
I love the comedian angle. I feel like if you went with a different comedian, one that was a little more, I'm not saying helpless, but like that can kind of downplay the friend zone type, like a Kyle Mooney or a John Mulaney. That type, I could see even like
Mulaney's
a Nick Kroll.
Gorgeous. What are you talking about?
I mean, maybe like a Nick Kroll or something like that. Like
Nick
I could
Kroll.
See. Or what's his name?
Would be great.
Or what's his name from the league? What's the Paul? What's his name? The
Paul Scheer.
Paul Scheer. Yeah, I could see him doing it too.
I love Paul Scheer.
Yeah.
Moving on. I love the Jesse Eisenberg. I like Bill Burr too. I mean, it changes the dynamic of the film a lot. It was a good reach by Warren. I enjoyed it, but I think Jesse takes this one here. Moving on for the recasting of Betsy. Phil, who do you have?
I brought up the big guns, A-lister. Haven't used her all season. You want someone that can be running the a politician's office or kind of, you know, working it from that angle, be higher up in that office environment. I went with Natalie Portman because I can see her doing the office side, being respected in that way. But at the same time,
she would be running for office. What the fuck are you talking about?
She can do anything. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, she. What are you talking about? Today, maybe 10 years ago, today she would be the main candidate. But I think you have to take into account where the type of actors, characters she's playing, and they're prestigious characters. They're not going to. She's not going to play someone an up and comer early in their career. See, that's the problem I have with the morning show. You got fucking Reese Witherspoon playing an up and comer reporter, and she's like the same age as Jennifer Aniston, who's supposed to be. It just doesn't make sense. So you got to cast with where the actor is in their career. Okay, as great as Natalie Portman is, she's already won an Oscar. She's not going to play Betsy because she's only in the first 30-40 minutes of the movie.
Oh, you're talking about like Margot Robbie and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
No, she's the third lead and she's spread throughout the film. She's a pivotal character.
Betsy is also a pivotal character in the film.
She's
very much a pivotal character.
An obsession point, a point of obsession for Travis, but in terms of screen time and lines, not given a lot to do. You'd be lucky
in the first
you
act.
Really,
and if a director with the caliber of Scorsese comes to call, yeah, she is going to take that.
Are you going to get like Julia Roberts or those?
Listen,
11,
this is
have
my
sign
dream.
For $20.
Listen, this is my dream casting. If I All feel right, like well, Natalie Portman's a good fit for Betsy, she's a good fit for Betsy.
All right, whatever. I went with Zoe Kravitz for the very reason I was talking about, an actress with where she is in her career right now. You would see her being an up-and-comer, running a campaign, probably one day being a politician herself. And also there's the element that Betsy, again, has this dreamy quality. Tom's in love with her. Travis is obsessed with her. You have to cast an actress who can, and I like to say, stop traffic and break your heart as she does it. That's Zoe Kravitz, man.
Both actresses are going to get their slow-mo intro in the white dress that Betsy gets in this film. My only thing, and I do love Zoe Kravitz. I've recasted her twice already this season, so you know I can't use her anymore. However, my only gripe about that is how she interacts with Travis in that relationship. And maybe this is me looking too much into the previous roles that she's played, but I just, you know, she doesn't seem like based on those past films, the type of character that's going to be embarrassed.
Well, this would be a period thing. If you're doing like the 70s or the New York cinema, there's a different societal standard. And she's a great actress. She has the range to be able to play a variety of characters, and she would be able to meet the demands that is required of the character.
I'm not saying she doesn't, but I'm going off of what I've seen her in. And I just don't see her type playing the type of character that's going to get embarrassed being taken to on a date with Travis.
You know, she has her She has her own show on Hulu where all she does is she's herself for 10 episodes, and it's amazing. So the character of Betsy has to have this lovable quality, a very likable quality, and I think Zoe Kravitz brings that in spades. Even in, I think of the cafe scene, her first date with Travis. you know, the dreamy eyes that she has looking at, I just could see Zoe just crushing that scene.
There's a coyness and an innocence to the character that Sybil Shepherd had that I just don't see with Zoe Kravitz. That's my thing. Whatever. But I would see with Natalie Portman.
All right. Order in the court. I can see both of these. I think, guys, both of them are a little off. All right. It makes it hard to put a judgment on it. But we're talking about a goody-goody two-shoe and somebody that's really naive. I do think Natalie's a little further along in her career than where she needs to be for this role, but I think that she has a better casting than Zoe for it. So I'm going to give Betsy to Phil.
Kind of the lesser of the two evils. All right.
Okay, I'll take that. A win's a win. All
right. Yeah, you know. Anyway, moving on to Iris. Phil, keep it going. Who you got?
Yeah, difficult recasting this role given the built-in controversial nature of the character itself. I went with Kiernan Shipka, most well known from Chilling Adventures of Sabrina on Netflix. She was a voice actor in the Legend of Korra Avatar animated series. So she's an up and comer, very much so given her age. But you want an actor that has to look the part, that is too young to be where they're at, but very much can put on the mask of, hey, I can hold my own here. There's that veiled maturity, but beneath the surface, they're really lost. Perfect fit for that.
Warren, who do you have?
For Iris, I went with Daphne Keene. She's at the great top of the list for her, you know, category. She was in Logan, most recently His Dark Materials. Very bankable actress. You know, she's going to bring the goods. For her age, she's got acting chops to go around. I mean, she can really carry scenes and really hold the camera in great projects. So I couldn't think of anyone else in terms of being age appropriate to play Iris.
She's great. I didn't even think of her, but yeah, she's got a bright future ahead of her. So I really do love that. So you can't go wrong. I think either one is going to be a good fit. It just, which one fits it a little better.
I think Daphne can play a lot more characters with her eyes, with her expressions, when looking at the character. Kiernan and Sabrina, she's going to have that blonde thing, that, you know, Hollywood thing, but I think that there's a darkness to this teenage child that's in the situation she's in.
It's a fair point.
And Daphne's got the ability to do some just amazing things. Just her expressionism and such a talent. I mean, such a young talent.
Oh, she's so good in Logan. Jesus. Oh.
Yes. That was an unbelievable casting. I wish I could give you more points for that one, buddy. That's a heck of a casting.
Tiebreaker.
Yeah, well, speaking of tiebreaker, which we will not have one, but should we need one?
It's not needed. It's a fucking blowout. I mean, Phil's already got second string out on the field.
Yeah.
Running up the scoreboard. Here's my chance.
Well, we should take a minute to note that Phil pulled from Star Wars, which falls in line with what Phil does.
That's fair.
When he doesn't reach into Stranger Things, so.
I'm pretty tapped out of the Stranger Things late in the season.
Yeah, you should have that barrels, but you're digging pretty deep. It's empty. Or damn near close.
All right, gentlemen.
You even casted Harbor like in an episode. I mean, now you moved on to the adult actors when you started
David
running
Harbor
out of kids.
as Kreese in Karate Kid. Yeah, he's perfect. I mean, I lost to you. You had Idris Elba, but still, I thought he was great.
All right, moving on to Travis Bickle. Warren, who do you have cast here?
There's only, in my opinion, 5-6 actors right now you could cast in this role. It takes a special actor to play Travis Bickle. They have to have the pedigree. We're recasting Taxi Driver. Acting chops are a prerequisite. They've got to be able to bring it. I thought of, there's a short list here. Michael Fassbender, Rami Malek, Joaquin Phoenix, but then, you know, the Joker, kind of, got to roll that out. So I went with Adam Driver.
Phil, who do you have here for Travis Bickle?
Well, I thought of an actor who's got a bright career in front of them, a lot of talent, a lot of potential in what they can do, and this is would be a breakout role for them, something like this. I went with Bill Skarsgård. It's mainly because I can see the two sides of Travis Bickle. Early on in the film, yes, he internalizes a lot of things. Not a good person, but he has moments of charm and where he's likable, whether it be the scene in the diner with Iris or or when he's having breakfast, or the coffee date with Betsy. You like the guy, you root for the guy, but he can make that turn where he is, you know, especially in the latter half of the Mohawk stage of the film, where he just goes pure evil and just is scary. Bill Skarsgård, I mean, no better actor. I do love the Adam Driver one, though. I will hand
again,
you
all due respect to him as an actor, but I think you have to go with an elite actor. And Adam Driver is a very elite actor. I mean, the best actors can do two things at once, sometimes three if they're cooking. Adam Driver, you need that with Travis Bickle. Adam Driver is going to bring that complexity with the character, the subtlety, the subtext, the specificity, the body language, you know, between the way the character changes, you know, where early on Travis Bickle's slouching, and then once he starts to transition, he starts, his posture changes, his eyes focus more. I mean, it is a physical performance as much as it is a mental one.
Yeah, I just see that craziness that you get with Pat Bickle. Maybe because I've seen him as in the It films as Pennywise the Clown, and other things as well. But I mean, he has those eyes that are just, I don't know, he just psychotic almost when he wants them to be. But at the same time, he can be a baby doll and can, you know, be very charming.
So, I will say this: I think Bill is an outstanding actor. I can't think of the series that he did on Netflix, but he played a role similar to this where he's kind of this rich, you know, kid that some kind of vampire thing, but I mean, ends up with that serial killer mentality, and there's certain scenes and there's a lot in the eyes. It was a real big stretch or reach, I would have to say, for Phil to go with Bill, but you're going to get rewarded here. I like that. I like that casting.
Nice.
Well done.
Thank you.
Bullshit.
I am a golden god.
Gentlemen. Recasting court is adjourned.
All right, fan theory time. Got to talk about this one because it is the fan theory that I thought of when I first watched the movie, as I'm sure a lot of people did. It has been addressed and discussed by Paul Schrader himself, but for the purposes of its popularity and putting things to bed, and also I want to see your opinion on it, Warren, before you hear what the writer said. The fan theory is that the last 5 minutes of the film, after the shootout, after that climactic scene, when Bickle comes out of the coma, a lot of people watching think that is a dream, and that did not actually happen. What do you think?
Oh, no, it did happen, and the only reason I don't have to speculate is because anytime a director doesn't leave it to the audience's imagination, they actually come in at an interview and explain it. It demystifies it, and Scorsese has said that it is real, that he's recovered, and it's actually a really cool moment when he grabs the rearview mirror at the end of the movie. That's the eternal time bomb, the resetting. So something else is going to happen. He's back on that downward spiral, that inevitable path.
There was actually a 2013 Ask Me Anything on Reddit with Paul Schrader, the writer, where he did back up what Scorsese said and said, no, this was definitively not a dream sequence. This did happen, and that you could look at the film as almost like that. That's the loop restarting. You could splice that last scene with the beginning of the movie and just, it would repeat itself, except this time Travis wouldn't be the hero. He is very much not cured, and that it's going to happen again. Again, like you said, the kind of a ticking time bomb aspect of it. So
probably won't have such a great outcome for him either. That was kind of an accident, a happy accident.
Yeah. And even when they would air it on television, it would come with a disclaimer by the filmmakers saying that, you know, this is depending on how things are perceived. They could be interpreted one way when a small thing changes and the outcome could have been completely different. This is a tragic situation. If he would have been a little bit faster drawing the gun on Palantine, he would very much be painted as an assassin, as a terrorist, and now he's the hero. So
he'd be in prison.
Right. So I just wanted to put it to bed because it's so popular and people still put it out there. This is a dream. It is not a dream. The filmmakers have come out and said it. It serves the purpose of the story of the film for it not to be a dream. So just accept that it was real. Move on.
And we'll close out the episode discussing the legacy of Taxi Driver, arguably one of the greatest movies of the 70s, heck, of all time. I hate for that to sound like hyperbole, but in this case, it's a very accurate statement.
Yeah, when you look at the list that it's on and what it's made, it's clear that that it deserves to be in that conversation. I do want to quickly say that Paul Schrader himself, you know, he took that character of Taxi Driver, and when he moved on to directing, he had a difficult time stepping away from the Travis Bickle character he created. So when he went on to direct American Gigolo, Light Sleeper, and The Walker, he considers those films to be a part of the Man in the Room or Night Worker series, where it's maybe a different name, but it is the same character. So those went on to inspire his works, his directing works that he did. So there is a reason that it's considered to be among the greats, because it still, it even inspired the writer himself to keep going on with that, that type of role.
Well, specifically, it's, I would say most definitely is cinema's greatest first person character study. I can't think of another film that even comes close, in terms of staying with one character all the way through the movie like that. And it just being top to bottom, a great film start to finish. And there was some religious symbolism with this character, you know, a saint who wants to purge himself of weakness and sin, which we see that transition with the character. And then, of course, the end, you know, that's a suicide mission. He's willing to die at the end. We all know that, the samurai death, the honorable death, for a heroic purpose. So you Scorsese discussed some of that. Other themes of the film, of course, the loneliness and alienation, in this case, self-inflicted, the violence, toxic masculinity, justice and judgment, intent versus action, purity and innocence, vigilantism and racism. You also have the neo-noir film noir elements as well.
That self-inflicted loneliness, that I know that's a common theme, I don't necessarily agree with. It's pretty clear with the medications that Bickle is on and what he goes through and just his demeanor that he does have some mental health issues, and that's not necessarily easy to overcome. I mean, even though like the Taxi Driver's wizard, they're friendly with him, you know, if he doesn't feel like he can connect with him, you know, that's not necessarily on him. So I feel like it's kind of difficult to quantify watching the film, that it's self-inflicted, because I mean, a part of that just might be the way that he's wired. But I do feel like that's why you see so much of that, replicated, in other films with those characters, that, you know, so many people have tried to recreate the Travis Bickle type character based upon the themes that you do see in the film.
Perhaps. I mean, the guy definitely had some serious mental health issues. He was a deeply troubled schizophrenic racist. I mean, we see the world through his eyes. I mean, you understand and relate with the character's loneliness. And then the character deceives you. He goes down this whole other road. He just descends into absolute madness and craziness. And we see how racist this character is. Despite what he believes are heroic intentions, the guy is not a hero. He's not one to be looked up to.
That's what I take away from the film now watching it, is that, you know, he's the villain in a lot of ways, in many ways.
Yeah.
And in no way should you look at him as the hero. And I think when I watched the film when I was younger, you were pulling for Bickle. You know, you were wanting to see him do well. And like, yes, it may have been, you know, a failed assassination attempt, but then he redeems himself as the hero. And that's not the takeaway you should have from the film. And it's, you know, you watch him and in no way should he be looked at as the good guy.
Yeah, absolutely not. And some of the biggest impacts of this movie, number one, it established Martin Scorsese as a premier auteur. This put him on the elite directors list.
And rightly so. I mean, again, a small budget, $1.9 million, and what he did with it. I mean, there are filmmakers that could have, you know, nowadays, it's a different era, but they could have 10, 100 times that budget, wouldn't be able to make a film that has impacted society in the way that this one has. This didn't necessarily create the talent level of Martin Scorsese that we know today, but this brought it to everyone's attention that here is a guy that can make masterpieces.
Exactly. Yeah, he was already great, but this the world came to know who he was. Right. This also sealed Robert De Niro's reputation as one of our greatest actors. As we mentioned, he did turn down the big money to do this project. They gained him a lot of respect.
Which is crazy that he, to this day, has only won two Academy Awards for acting. So the supporting actor for Godfather Part II and then the lead actor for Raging Bull. It's crazy he did not win for this film.
That was 40 years ago.
Yeah, man, it's crazy.
Another big impact, and we mentioned it earlier, is this movie's got one of the top 10 most iconic lines in cinema history. Bar none, it's on the short list.
One of the most, I would say, impersonated, too. One, you know, everyone has acted out in front of a mirror their take on that line. Most people misquote it, but everyone's done that in front of a mirror before.
Another way I think this movie lives on and the impact it's had is it captures a certain period of New York City that just doesn't exist anymore. It's this like time capsule of Manhattan in the 70s where Times Square was a shithole.
A lot of places in New York were that have now been built up and are like, you know, very prestigious areas where it's expensive real estate that were in a sense, you know, condemned properties back then. So yeah, you get to see this time capsule of New York before it made the turnaround that you fortunately have seen today.
And I would say lastly is, you know, Schrader's script was partly inspired by the failed assassination of George Wallace. And we saw the direct impact of this movie with John Hinckley with the assassination attempt on President Ronald Reagan. He was obsessed with this movie.
Yeah, he was obsessed with this movie. He said he did it to impress Jodie Foster, which made a lot of news headlines. He ended up being acquitted due to insanity. Good case by his lawyers, I guess, which is, you know, nuts that he got off on that. And it impacted Scorsese, though. I mean, he almost considered stepping away from filmmaking because of the negative impact that this film did have on society and the real world implications. So, I mean, this has inspired a lot of filmmakers, yes, but also real life wannabe.
Yeah, I don't think you can shame the movie. John Hinckley would have found some other vessel to be inspired by to wreak havoc or murder or try to kill somebody. Taxi Driver, just he happened to see it on the wrong day. That's all that is.
Well, not only that, because I mean, the fact that it came out, this movie, it did inspire other vigilante films or vigilante film wave, despite this film not really being classified as a vigilante film. A lot of people wanted to mimic it, of course, you know, Hollywood copying ideas and whatnot. You're right, though. If it wasn't this movie, it would have been another one that would have pushed a whack job like Hinckley.
Or an album or piece of art.
Other films that did inspire directly, though, Seven Psychopaths in 2012 actually had Sam Rockwell in it, claiming to be, he was a crazed Los Angeles actor who was claiming to be the illegitimate son of Travis Bickle. So never saw that, but it's got Rockwell in it, so I'd like to give it a shot. And then most recently, Todd Phillips's Joker, you watch that film and it is just plays just like an alternate DC reality of Travis Bickle and that character.
It's Taxi Driver's New York in that movie.
Yes, it very much so. It is. Yeah, I mean, it's Travis Bickle if he was the Joker in some aspects of it. You know, a little crazier, like the Joker would be.
Yeah, a little bit. You get thrown on the makeup, to a whole other level.
But heavily inspired by Taxi Driver, it's undeniable.
Other movies that Taxi Driver also has a connection with, 1,124 different titles. It's referenced in Training Day, which we have covered, Collateral, Iron Man 2, Simpsons, Django Unchained, The Big Lebowski, Jackie Brown, Office Space, Fight Club, Pulp Fiction, The Lion King, Desperado 7, and Fargo.
Several of those we've actually done in past episodes. That's crazy. Wow.
Not only those, Star Wars Episode 5 references it, Terminator, Friday the 13th, Untouchables, RoboCop, JFK, Unforgiven, and SNL. So many different iconic, memorable movies have made a direct reference to Taxi Driver.
And I would say most of it's because it's going to be the you talking to me. That's such an iconic scene and line that that's the one most people pull from in reference, because
that's the one that's
spoofed, most well known.
Yeah, that's the line that's spoofed the most. The movie was also spoofed in The Jerk, Evil Dead 2, Back to the Future 3, Aladdin, Shrek, The Sopranos, and Napoleon Dynamite. And some of the all-time lists in cinema history, AFI also ranked the movie 52 on the top 100 movies of all time. Travis Bickle is the 30th best villain of all time and number 22 on the top 100 thrillers of all time.
I'm glad he made a villains list, because just further reinforcing, yeah, this guy is not good.
Yeah, okay. Not a hero, yeah. The movie was also on Roger Ebert's great movie list, and Quentin Tarantino placed it on his top 12 greatest movies of all time. The Directors Guild of America ranked it 44th. The greatest directed movie of all time. The Writers Guild of America ranked it 43rd, the greatest script ever written. And Time Magazine also selected Taxi Driver as one of the 100 best films of all time. Can't name all the lists, but that's some of the highlights.
Enough that you know that it's in a top list like that, it's making an appearance, and deservedly so. I'm surprised that, when we were researching for the pod, I was surprised. I'm like, why haven't they done anything else with Taxi Driver? A video game? where my mind goes. But or another TV series, sequel, whatever. Actually, in 2005, a Taxi Driver sequel was briefly announced by Scorsese and De Niro. Clearly, nothing ended up happening to it. They did go back and forth with Schrader, trying to work on a script, get something made about Travis later in life, where De Niro would reprise his role. But in 2013, after Schrader did a first draft, the idea was quickly dropped the following year, and there's not really been any inklings about it since then.
It all starts with the script. Got to have a good story.
Yep, exactly.
If you're going to get Scorsese and De Niro to commit to it.
Yeah, it's going to have to be especially good, which the bar is set so high for the original. Why revisit?
Why mess
it's
with done. It?
Yeah, step away.
And some of the directing trademarks of Martin Scorsese, when you see consistent with a lot of his movies, New York stories, a lot of his films take place in and around New York, anti-heroes and gangsters, powerful women, chatty narrators, mirrors with characters alone, a lot of freeze frame shots, Catholic references and ideology, long takes, like the walk and talk, most famously of the Copacabana and Goodfellas, a lot of improv in his movies, and of course, a lot of profanity.
Yes, the staples, very, especially those latter two of Scorsese. So, but some great films as a result, but memorable pieces of filmmaking.
And I would say most uniquely, the fact he was one of the first filmmakers to use artist music as opposed to always using a composer or a score.
Correct, yes. Not in this film so much, but very much so in his later works and ones we see to this day. And along with Quentin Tarantino as someone who does that, which, I'm a huge fan of.
Yeah, my favorite director of all time. In 1994... Taxi Driver was selected for preservation by the U.S. Library of Congress and the National Film Registry. So one of the highest honors that can be bestowed upon a movie.
Of all the films that would be considered for that, this one's up there in that list.
And Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times summed it up best when he said, quote, "A brilliant nightmare, and like all nightmares, it doesn't tell us half of what we want to know," unquote.
That is going to do it for this episode of Replay Value. Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe to the podcast, and if you love what you hear, take the time to rate, review, and share with a friend. You can visit us on our website, replayvaluepod.com, and follow us on Twitter, @replayvaluepod. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every other Tuesday, and we'll see you then.
Bye! Bye.
This has been a Waldo Pickles production.